Yes? Who's it?
Don.
Hello and welcome to the Ogre Cave Audio Report, recording on Sunday, October 29th, 2006. This is Mike Sugarbaker.
And this is Alan Sugarbaker.
And this is Chris Hanrahan with Endgame of Oakland, California.
So a couple of things resembling news have happened.
Hooray.
Yeah, the World of Warcraft CCG came out, and this, you know, I'm thinking about it as news because this to me is the test, you know. Mm-hmm. Are we full of crap? Are other people full of crap? Well, presumably somebody somewhere is full of crap, and
I think we're at least half full.
Yes. Is the glass half full or half empty
exactly of
crap? That's what we're testing with the WoW CCG.
Yeah. You know, the shotgun finally hit the target, you know.
It really does kind of feel like a blunt tool in some ways.
Just beat the hell out of something, yeah.
Yeah. I do own a starter. Am I alone in this, or do either of you?
I resisted temptation myself. I had a stack of boosters and a starter, and I put them back.
Mm.
And I didn't even get that close.
The first thing that was a warning sign to me is that there's apparently 9 different fixed components of the box. Like, mm-hmm. They give you 2 boosters, and they really are, they just stuck 2 boosters in there,
mm-hmm.
And then they have about half a deck's worth of fixed cards, and there's 9 different characters that are built out of those fixed cards. You will get one of them at random, and in the box, there's no way to tell.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the first turnoff for, you know, core hobby gamers who aren't hardcore CCG people or hardcore WoW people or whatever.
So let's stop right there. So we got the game in on, Wednesday, I think it was, last week. We got in 3 boxes of starters, which is 18 starters, and 7 boxes of boosters, 2 of which were pre-orders. By Friday evening at 5 p.m., I was out of starters and down to 2 boxes of, boosters. So I had a couple people come in and buy multiple starters for the exact reason that there were 9 different characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked each one of these guys, I'm like, what do you do? Do you play? Because I had to know, right? Do you guys play CCGs? Do you play WoW? Or do you got both going on? And each person was hardcore into WoW and kind of like CCGs, maybe played some Magic, and were buying these things basically because, you know, they like the video game.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting. I didn't expect to see a lot of that out of this, and that was
really
the majority of people who came in and bought it. Yeah. The in-game items are totally working for people, and the fact that they got some really big artists to do cards for this, I think, who's the Spawn guy?
Todd McFarlane.
Yeah, Todd McFarlane does some of the art on the cards, and some other big-name artists.
That's crazy. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that until I turned a starter over. And I think the starters are really, really cleverly packaged.
The boxes are wonderful.
Yeah, they look like a video game.
Yeah.
They will sit on a bookshelf and right next to your World of Warcraft, you know, limited edition collector set and look perfect next to each other. So it's hitting on a lot of different levels, and it is selling out everywhere. This is one of the only times in the last 2 years I've seen retailers up on our industry forums, you know, actively seeking product. And the distributors don't have more coming in until January, I think it is. And we missed the opportunity to, because we're lame, get one final reorder in with Upper Deck, like, on Thursday. And they'll get one more order out, and then they won't have more until January either. So, you know, this is what makes me nervous about the whole thing, right, is it going to work that they're stone cold out of product in the channel for 2 full months, you know, or is it sitting heavy in stores like GameStop and blah, 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 and can maintain its momentum? Mm-hmm. But I hate to see the game just go away for a couple months, because I don't know if that's going to work.
Yeah.
Or if it'll just build demand. So
That to me, that says that's not going to work for a CCG.
No. But now, again, let's just kind of say that I don't know where else the game is being sold. I haven't paid much attention. This caught us all off guard. I mean, come on, how many times have we seen a CCG come out in the last year and a half? You know, Battlestar Galactica, you know, Hecatomb, and just fail out the gate, right? So I can kind of see why Upper Deck has some availability problems. You know, if they print 25 billion cards and manage to sell 100,000, who eats it in the shorts on that one, right? But, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, that leaves us with two kind of dovetailing questions. One, is this a flash in the pan? And
right.
Two, what will sustain this game over time? Is it enough to have a strong brand that really appeals to people who, you know, were kind of into CCGs, but not enough to actually buy any of them until there was this brand?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that enough to sustain a game?
I don't
think
so.
And is someone going to crack the code on these little redeemable in-game things and just post them on their website somewhere? Or
I don't know.
What?
Well, I do know that one card in the set, it's like the Snapjaw Turtle. It's an upgrade, a cosmetic upgrade for your Epic Mount in-game. It's like going for $300 on eBay, or was on Friday. I haven't checked since then, but let's just assume it's going for a couple $100, right?
Mm-hmm.
So already there's an aftermarket for these cards in 2 days of release, 3 days of release.
Yes, I just wonder if the stuff that's for another game that's
mm-hmm.
sprinkled into this game,
mm-hmm.
will and, you know, that's been the question from the beginning, I suppose, is whether that will keep it going. Chris, here's a question for you.
Sure.
The people who pre-ordered boxes,
uh-huh.
are they, like, known to you? Are they CCG
yeah.
players? Or?
Yeah, he's a Magic player, and he also is a collectibles person. He buys a lot of Star Wars minis,
mm.
and he buys a lot of D&D minis. He buys a couple boxes of Magic each release. So it wasn't surprising. Frankly.
Okay. So
he's no test model for me.
Right.
Now to get back to something you were just talking about a moment ago, you know, somebody just kind of said something really straightforward and honest to me about the CCG that just, you know, duh, right? I'm like, you know, it really surprised a lot of people, myself included, that WoW made it, you know? And he's like, he looks at me, he goes, dude, there's 7 million people playing this computer game. You know, if even 10% want it, that's big right out the gate, you know? And I'm like, damn, that's really true. So even if 10%, even if they get 10% conversion on this, that's 700,000 people.
10%
you know?
Is a lot.
Yes. And you know, 10% is a lot, but the cross-merchandise for WoW has been doing really, really well. So, you know,
there's not very much of it.
That's the point.
Yeah.
No, there's not. And this is a big, huge release. You know, this is... I would say this is probably the largest piece of merchandise for the game yet, you know? In terms of scope.
There could be no card game at all, and they could do just fine with these codes being in there.
Yeah. You know, they could have sold these to Kellogg's or something, you know?
Anyway.
I'm really surprised that it went this way, and there might be some synergy here that makes both companies some decent money. So, I don't know. They just have it down in terms of the big box retailers, you know,
mm-hmm.
they're the one that's still in there and in there hard, you know, with Yu-Gi-Oh! and a couple
yes.
of other smaller titles. So
yes,
this may work real well.
Well, just following the Ron Popeil method, if you get 1% turnaround,
yeah,
that's still 70,000.
Yeah.
That's plenty.
I mean, how many, let's just even say 5% at 350,000 people. What game on the market, aside from maybe Magic and Dungeons and Dragons, can say that they actively have that many people playing?
Right.
You know, that's pretty huge. So, yeah, duh. Maybe we should have thought about that when we were placing orders for the game, you know? So.
But then, as you say, it does turn into whether or not this game will live past the lag period that they've got right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, if I had been offered returnability on this, I think we would have doubled our order. You know, but, oh well. Our loss
yeah.
on this one.
Yeah. That's a thing, you know, we've been down on CCG publishers for so long,
yep.
but they face a big challenge now, is that retailers have become gun shy, you know,
yep.
at long last.
Yeah.
So
no,
it's hard
totally.
For them to know how much to print.
Agreed. You know, we don't bring CCGs in anymore. It's done, you know, and this mm-hmm. one was just like, okay, one more, you know, we'll see what happens with one more if it's Warcraft. You know, and holy crap.
Right. Right. So, yeah. WoW CCG, one big sexy question mark at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a really good way of looking at it.
Other bit of news this week. Huge Tempest in a fairly small teapot. Drive-Through RPG, the PDF sales site, has merged with RPG Now.
Mm-hmm.
And they will be becoming one site.
One bookshelf.
And there is lots of what you might call kerfuffle over, you know, which policies from which site will now be applied to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I just learned, you know, in the course of this, all the internet discussion of that there is one of these sites, and I forget which one, that actually charges people just to get listed, which to me is flabbergasting.
Yeah. It's funny. I can't help but think whenever I read this story, like, you know, Wonder Twin powers, you know, activate. You know, form of one big, ugly, you know, PDF site, right?
Form of basically the same thing we already were, yeah.
Yeah, it seems like, again, Tempest in a teapot because, you know, again, whatever, we've got $2 PDFs and, you know, we've got $20 PDFs and they're all yeah. in the same place and it's confusing, so great.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of discussion on our own comments about, you know, what price point PDFs ought to set in order to correctly give the impression that gaming has value,
right?
You know, and to not just suck money out of the whole industry,
right?
Well, they do bring in money even at the low price points. I have seen a small company that I won't name right now, but a small company that was at the forefront of RPGNet's little downloadable shop when they had one of those. And it made several thousand dollars just on RPGNet. It wasn't even listed on RPG Now at all at the time.
Is it per month or per year or what?
That was in an 8-month period, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, that's the scale that I think is probably the ceiling for people who don't also publish print products.
Right. I mean, it certainly wasn't, at least I don't think it was, the full-time job of any of the participants. It was kind of a side venture.
Can we step back for just one second here and really kind of say that number again? Because $7,000, I don't want to take anything away from anybody, but that's nothing. You know,
yeah,
that is
not
a lot of money, you know. And I'd like to then take one further step back and say, divide that by the amount of man hours that went into the product sold.
True.
And then give me that number. And if it's anything, you know, less than, you know, 75 hours or whatever my math is, pardon me, but I don't want to hear it be, well, of course there was, you know, 9,000 hours put into these PDFs, you know. Great, so you're making 35 cents an hour or something like that?
I suspect that who we're talking about is Philip Reed.
No.
And again, that's not, I have no inside knowledge, I don't know, but that would be my first guess.
It's wrong, but okay.
Okay. I know that he does okay business, too, and it is on the scale of thousands of dollars in a year.
Mm-hmm.
But for something that a lot of people just do anyway,
mm-hmm.
you know, I wouldn't turn down a few thousand dollars a year, you know, for a hobby business.
Sure.
You know, that it's something that can be built on, and I think PDFs are still at the stage where it makes sense to invest in it as a field in general and expect that more will come out in the future.
Yeah, I think I want to make it really, really clear and quickly here that it's not PDFs that I don't respect. It's those micropayments that I don't have a lot of love for. You know, I've spent money. I've spent $25 on a PDF to get a sneak peek at a BattleTech product. That's fine, you know. Not much less than the actual retail price of the printed book. You know, they're making their money for it. And I just kind of have a weird, it's not me owning a store or anything. It's just I have a really hard time of people not putting a real tangible value to their work, you know, but that's just me. So,
well, whether it's splitting up your costs between little tiny PDFs for your RPG that could have been put into one big print product, or micropayments to get all of the cars in some new Xbox Live game or something like mm-hmm. that, it's annoying no matter what form the micropayments come in. So
mm-hmm.
yeah, I have to agree entirely.
When you put out a PDF of, you know, 100 magical halberds for $2,
mm-hmm.
then, yeah, you're devaluing, you know, a lot of other people's work just by driving the average down.
Right.
And, yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying, you know. Just at the same time, I'm happy they're out there doing it. I'm happy that there are people who get pleasure out of it, and that's great. I don't have to like it. You know, that's fine. It's just my mm-hmm. opinion.
And at the same time, if somebody made 100 magical halberds and put them out there in HTML for free, I would not have a problem with that. I would think that was awesome.
Me either. I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
You know, that's adding value to something that, well, I don't want to get into moral statements, but
well,
there you go.
What I would state about it is just that we need to destroy fake professionalism in order uh-huh. to make way for real professionalism.
Yeah.
You know, people, there's a lot of people out there who are kind of role-playing a company.
Yes.
That's another good way to put it, yeah.
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 Pretending yeah. to be a company instead of actually being a company.
Yeah, that's the only negative side of PDFs.
Yeah.
Is that the fact that they're out there, that people see this measly little opportunity, keeps them from seeing the real opportunity of a free and open discussion.
No, right. I think all the big companies have kind of seen that this is another venue to get their materials out there, especially their old out-of-print things that they can't afford to do print runs of anymore.
Well, they're charging the right amount of money for it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's not a brand new 200-page product. It's a two-year-old 200-page product that everyone already bought in print form.
And they're charging what it would cost, you know, prior to printing. So, I mean, they're still making a profit off of something that, you know, they're pricing it right. They're not just going, well, this thing is, you know, old and out of print. Let's just sell it for a dollar.
Yeah.
Like, no, let's charge slightly less because we didn't have to pay China to print it and,
right,
you know,
right.
still make, you know, what the salary should have been for those people who did it.
Yeah, they're keeping the value up on something that people do value.
Right, yeah. Right. And again, I also have no problem with the manufacturers who charge, you know, $25 of a $34 book or whatever early. You know, sure, send that PDF out. You know, get the word around. If people like it, they'll buy the print game too. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Right on.
Dead horse.
Yeah, certainly now it is, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to take credit for killing that horse.
Yeah. Beating it dead.
May or may not have been dead previously.
So I'm
yes,
going to move
what
on.
You got?
I'm going to move on because I have I just listened to the previous show that Steve was kind enough to jump in on, and I have 4 points to make from that. Number one, thank you for the plugs. Alan, I think I covered you on Saturday, so we're good there.
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
Let's see. Food at GTS is absolute crap. I don't really, you know, we all have different tastes and that's fine, but those buffets are just god awful. I'm sorry.
But these are at resorts with a rather poor reputation.
Well, but hey, I'm just, you know, I'm refuting comments I heard on the previous show. You know, I heard things such as, well, they're not half bad. You know, you got bacon and blah, blah, blah. I should point out that if you're a vegetarian, you are screwed, at their little buffet things, which is kind of harsh, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's just kind of akin to dog meat. So
a lot of that stuff is served atop lettuce, though. So, you know.
Well, yeah, I suppose you could just, you know, shake it off a little and move on with it,
there
right? And there's always the bread.
Scrape off the bacon fat.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Oh.
If you guys, no, point three, if you would like to find out if I'm a poker shark, we could meet up in Vegas.
I'm so not there for that.
And number four, you had a very interesting discussion on innovation versus competition in local game stores. And, you know, just, you know, to give another perspective on that really quickly, we have, I think I've mentioned this several times, we have the largest concentration and density of game stores in a metro area.
Yeah.
Pretty much around,
okay.
You know. And I have a lot of competitors, whether or not we choose to see each other's competition. I get along very, very well with, I don't know, a good handful of the other game store owners in the Bay Area. We cross, you know, do cross-bay tournaments. We'll trade stock. If, you know, something's not selling for me, I'll trade, you know, with something that's not selling for somebody else or blah, blah, blah.
That sort of thing just makes sense.
It's helpful.
It does. Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, I also have to realize, you know, I have to do something different to get those X amount of gamers in the Bay Area to come to my store instead of A, not going anywhere at all, or B, you know, maybe going to one of those other stores, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, as you were mentioning before, two of my local competitors choose to do it on price, and price exclusively, and that's fine. You know, overall it hurts their business, and that's really kind of tough, but we choose to do it through innovation, as you were kind enough to bring up. But damn, it's hard, you know. And I do have to kind of be mindful of my competition, you know. So I don't think they can be mutually exclusive, you know, to be innovative and not competitive at the same time. But yeah, I just wanted to throw that in there really quick.
No, I didn't mean to say that stores should be innovative and not competitive.
No, I'm not suggesting that. But it's just I just want to strike at how difficult it is. You know, you can be innovative and come up with, you know, things like mini cons, run those four times a year, run, you know, big massive diplomacy tournaments, you know, host puzzle competitions, that sort of thing, right?
Right.
But damn, you know, when you've got other people discounting or this goes on or that goes on, all of that doesn't always matter. You know, it's just tough.
It just seems to me that to run a game store properly, you kind of have to take all of your passions and knowledge of the gaming scene at that time and make your gaming life happen at the store with as much resources as you can pull into it. And just
it's really
big events and just network like crazy.
Yep.
And really make your store the hub of gaming activity for as many people as you can.
Yeah,
and that's got to be so hard to do.
It's hard to do, and then there's that whole category of gamer that has no interest in that. That's mm-hmm. not at all what they're looking for in their gaming experience. You know, I forget that sometimes because I've always been a public gamer. I have no issue setting down a board game at a convention and playing it with somebody, you know. But there's some people who their gaming does not exit their home, you know. And with
right.
the internet, that makes it even easier. They don't ever have to go to a game store and network with people. You know, mm-hmm. So that's, you know, how do you attract those people in, right?
Well, they have to come down and get the World of Warcraft CCG.
Yeah, exactly. or they can just go on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh, yeah,
it's true, but they'll pay $300 for the turtle.
Yeah, well, that's a good turtle. Anyway, so that was just my thanks to Steve for stepping in. You guys should have him on more often because they play games more often than I do for sure. So,
well, he's probably going to be doing some segments for us on a. How Dr. Comics and Mr. Games feels about various games they're considering stocking. So
interesting.
We'll be hearing from them again.
Yeah, they roll through a lot of board games over there.
They sure do.
Seems
sure
to be efficient.
Like yeah.
Chris, you also wanted to jump in on some of the Gen Con SoCal discussion.
Yeah, there was one thing that I was listening to in the show last week that I'm not sure if you guys knew this or not when you were having the conversation. True Dungeon almost didn't happen at SoCal this year. The Marriott, I have a friend who goes down there on business quite a bit, and he stays at the Marriott in Anaheim.
Mm-hmm.
And the area that True Dungeon was in last year is under total renovation right now. And those rooms may not have been available, so they were really concerned about finding space. And to which I kind of went, wait, are you seriously telling me at Gen Con SoCal you can't find space for an event? You know, just roll up Pikachu in the carpet that he died on and,
yeah.
You know, throw up some black gothy curtains and you're good to go, right? But so, like, I think they found out, like, the day of or the day after registration began for SoCal because none of the True Dungeon events were on registration the day that
oh,
it
wow.
launched. And they got confirmation that they were going to have space and they were able to start selling the tickets, like, I'm just going to say 3 days in, maybe it was four or something like that. So there almost was no SoCal. So that was one of the reasons
well,
why...
Well, there was still a SoCal, but almost
I'm
no
sorry, True Dungeon.
Dungeon.
Right.
Wow.
And I was considering doing it until, A, I found out it's the same mod that they were running in Indy, And B, I'm not really that excited about plunking down $30 for something they have 6 weeks to pull together. You know, so that's my little take on True Dungeon. So.
Do we know that it takes them any longer than 6 weeks to put something together?
Well, they have to get. I don't know that. I'm just thinking from an event coordination standpoint. You know, you can't put a call out for volunteers until you know you're doing it. So that's what they did. They put a call out for volunteers immediately after they announced the event, right?
Really?
And yeah. So I'm thinking that, you know, not to disparage their efforts, because maybe this only takes them 4 weeks. I have no clue, right? But that just concerns me as a, you know, as an attendee that, wow, you know, can they get the stuff out from the East Coast and reassemble it and touch it up and do all that sort of stuff, you know, along with build an entire crew, you know, get them trained over the next, you know, over a few weekends before, blah, blah, blah. That sounds like a lot of stuff to do in 6 weeks. But
especially since True Dungeon is all about who ends up being your game master.
Yeah.
And admittedly, they've said they're going to have one for each room, so they'll have specialized knowledge for that room. They'll know how to handle that room well, supposedly.
Yeah.
But in the past, if you got stuck with someone that wasn't that good with it or didn't want to listen to the player's concerns or whatever,
right,
you could have a horrible experience.
And I know one person who's doing it this time, and it's his first time, so that's kind of good, because I'll be able to take, you know, trade notes. So
true virgin.
Yeah, true virgin.
Nice.
Yeah.
I have to say, what alarms me about all this is the Gen Con organization. I mean, they have to know that True Dungeon is SoCal's bread and butter, at least right now.
You would think.
And, you know, you'd think that they would have bent over backwards to get them a space and get them everything that they needed.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know what went down. Maybe the hotel didn't give them forewarning. Or enough forewarning.
Yeah. You know, benefit of the doubt, it's fine. It's just they're on their fourth year, and if they're still having snags like this, that really, to me, that seems like a really big snag. That's something that you're on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You have two places set aside for True Dungeon in case the first one floods. You know, that's really, that's what you do.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the Versus guys don't get a big, you know, armored fist coming out of the ground because they need a space for True Dungeon. You know.
Just that one spot.
Yeah.
True Dungeon is going to be in that 20 by 20 square walled off by curtains.
Yeah. So I know you guys talked about it a little last week, but I'll be at SoCal. I'm going to get down on Thursday.
You are still going despite that
I'm still
discouraging
going.
Info.
Yeah. Well, my friends and I have decided to make it a yearly vacation. We're just going to go down and hang out in Anaheim and, you know, go to Disneyland or whatever and just hang out. So if there's a SoCal there, that's, you know, a Gen Con SoCal there, that's great. And if not, well, we'll go anyway.
Just have your own little game convention at the at the Californian resort or whatever.
Yeah, you know, wherever we end up.
Nice.
So we're going to go down. I'm going to be part of the podcasting seminar this time. That's on Saturday at 2, and I know that's in their crazy-ass Excel, you know, googly-gawk that they have on their website, so you should probably be able to find that. I know. Paul Tevis is hosting it. I know Mike Montessa is going to be there, and I'm not sure who else, so it might be a small panel, and hopefully we see some of y'all there, so I'll be there representing.
Cool.
So that was my exciting news. And then we're going to go to Disneyland. So there you go.
All right. All right. So Endgame had the mini-con.
We did.
And I'm just going to say, like, we're kind of just gradienting into currently playing now because you presumably played a couple of things and you got to look at the preview of Battle Lore.
Yeah. Why don't I just quickly mention Battle Lore? Man, that was fun. I didn't get to play it because I was running the mini con. I know. And slightly.
I got to look in the box.
You did? You know, I let you fondle it. I was way too stressed about trying to, like, keep the store together, and, you know, I was running a PTA game for the first time, you know, in a couple hours, and I'm like, I can't learn the whole command and color system and do that. So I missed that. But, man, is it a nice-looking game. We had a number of people. I'm going to say we were in the double digits of people who came down just specifically to demo Battle Lore. Paul Tevis has a really good roundup of his play during that session, so you can go over to Half Games Will Travel and listen to that, because that's pretty detailed if you want actual play kind of stuff.
Right on.
I would say we what are we at now? 7 or 8 prepaid orders for the $70 game.
Nice.
Yeah, that's pretty significant. That feels good, you know, for something that has a fairly meaty price tag to it. And it is a meaty box. It's a Days of Wonder size box. It's about 30 or 40% bigger than one of their normal boxes, and packed full of stuff.
Full.
And man, it must have cost them a fortune, but they had everything pre-cut and ready to go, you know, in like little carrying cases and stuff. And what a nice touch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They've got that two-sided board, which I think is neat, because they have that other side of the board for something they're calling Epic Battle Lore, which they haven't even developed yet. And that Epic Battle Lore will basically mean you and a buddy who both own it will be able to push your boards together and play a big game of Battle Lore
once they
do it. But it was cool that they were thinking ahead. You know, like, let's see what we can do with this unused space on the back of this board. You know, let's take the expense and put something there. And, man, that's one of those products that it sure doesn't look like they spared much expense. You know, the packaging, the art.
Over 200 figures in there or something like that?
200 figures, yeah.
Yeah,
and they're nice.
Unpainted, but still, they were. They're really nice.
Yeah, and I think they mentioned something about people asking why they didn't have them painted. And they were talking about it making each set cost about $125. And I would not be surprised if we don't see some very limited edition, you know, painted sets. But that is totally my speculation.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, that'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Would this thing have sold at $125 painted?
Yeah.
I don't know if it quite would have.
Well, in a limited collector's run, I think so.
I think I would have sold a couple. And after selling, like, I think I've sold 7 or 8 copies of the 3D Settlers at almost $400 a copy. I think I could have sold some of those.
Yeah.
You know? That's not even really stretching it, so.
Oh, they've got web support for the game as well, with an adventure editor that uses graphics from the game.
Yep.
I'm kind of wondering if Battle Lore players that have also played other miniatures type of games will break out the Heroescape hexes and build their own terrain with that. Since both games use hexes, then why the hell not?
OMG. I can't believe I didn't think of that.
Yeah, no, that's pretty cool.
Oh.
That's pretty damn cool. Alan is thinking ahead.
There's a lot of Heroescape sets floating around out there, too.
Yeah, there are.
I'm just saying.
There are. I was just painting mine, but that's a whole other story. Yeah, so anyway, Battle Lore was exciting. It was really neat because they hadn't even seen one opened yet. The other copies were at Essen. So that was just kind of fun. And then I ran a Primetime Adventures second edition game.
Yes, how did it go?
It was great. What I did find in a little troublesome, and you know, maybe this would get better over time with, you know, the same group. They were really excited about conflict. Should I go a little into PTA or should
please,
I just assume?
Please.
Okay, so Primetime Adventures works in such that you're framing your gaming as an episode of television that is more likely than not part of a series. You can also run things as like pilots and stuff like that, but let's just assume your gaming group is now running a television show. The game master takes the role of the producer, and the producer doesn't necessarily make up the show, because then you have everyone else who's playing a character within the TV show, and you're going to start talking about, you know, in your first session, who your characters are, you know, what they do, and what they're trying to accomplish to help kind of better set the episode, you know. So each time you play, one of the characters will have story priority, and this goes from 1 to 3. 3 being the main character of that episode, 2s being the main supporting, you know, actors in that episode, or characters, and then 1s being kind of everyone else, right?
This so is, they do this have is screen presence.
Yes, a screen presence.
Story priority is certainly a valid way of thinking about it.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
It does have its own term, but I have one of my own in my head.
Right.
So then the producer is going to get a budget based upon, you know, a calculation and that screen presence rating from all the characters, right? So you're playing in an episode, and you know, you've got these characters. Now, for a one shot, the screen priority, screen presence did not really factor in too much, because during a one shot it's really hard to frame, you know, an episode around someone who hasn't played the game before. So I just really tried to make it easy and just kind of assign the numbers arbitrarily for this one shot. But when the characters, you know, are coming up with an actual scene, they're thinking of something, you know, to do, you know, where, what are they trying to accomplish, and what will the conflict be, you know, so that they can make that accomplishment, or, you know, whatever it is in the scene. It's kind of cool because it uses playing cards. I actually don't remember, you know, I know reds are successes and blacks aren't, and then what is it, hearts trump diamonds or something like that for...
Something like that.
Yeah, I don't have the actual mechanic stuck in my head yet.
Yeah, so you count successes that way, but then the high card gets to actually say what happens.
Correct. So the narrator may actually be the person who's lost the conflict, which is interesting in itself. So... The thing I enjoyed most about the game was how everyone was working so hard on framing this world. So I ran it as Shadowrun, and I don't think a majority of the group was familiar very much with Shadowrun. I had to do a lot of explaining on what the Shadowrun concept was, and they ran with it. It was really interesting. And the only stumbling block that I felt was, I don't know if this is a characteristic of the system itself or how I explained it or what, but they were very eager to find conflict, you know, rather than being eager to frame conflict into a story they were telling, they were very eager to find conflict. Maybe that gets better. I don't know.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, there's, you can be telling a story, right, and make the story flow into a conflict. Okay, mm-hmm. You know, okay, so I'm going to approach the building, you know, because I have, you know, this idea that inside this building are these people and blah, blah, blah. So you're telling the story of what your character's going through rather than, okay, so I need to get into this room and there's these guys guarding it and my ultimate goal is to get the data stick behind the door. Okay, so I'm going to shoot them. Okay, so the conflict is you're going to shoot them. Yes. So to me, the difference there is they're eager to find answers to their questions rather than telling the story about the question itself. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've played a couple of games of Primetime Adventures, and it took me a while to get my head around this. Is that
I can imagine.
Yeah, the rule in PTA is that the producer, you know, the game master, his or her job is to not only drive things towards conflict,
right,
but to make sure that the conflicts are about the character's issues,
right.
Every character is designed in with an issue, and yes, it's like an issue, like, you know, a therapist would say you have issues.
Right.
So that is, and that's hard to do.
Agreed.
You know, it's hard to get your head around doing that as a role player.
And really hard in a one shot with players you haven't worked with before.
Yeah, I would imagine that would actually be very difficult in a one shot. I was going to ask how well this game works as a one time deal.
Well, I've played it as one shots both times that I've played it, and it's worked great. But I did something differently than you did, Chris.
Okay.
Which is that we went ahead and mapped out people's screen presences over 5 episodes anyway.
Oh wow, interesting.
And in fact, we all did that first.
Okay.
And made sure that, you know, nobody's overlapped in a way that was weird. And then we looked at how they all mapped out and said, okay, well, this second episode here looks a little bit not too punchy. We have a couple of people with 2s there, and everybody else has 1s. So that's more of a plot-driven episode. That doesn't seem real juicy. We want something where at least one person has a 3.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's like their big pivotal episode where, you know, a lot of their issues get pounded on.
Okay, you're losing me a little bit here. You mapped out 5 episodes before the one you were playing.
Yeah.
But just in the term of points for each character?
That's the screen presence gets done this way. You pick one episode where you put your 3.
Okay.
And that's like your character's big pivotal episode.
All right.
Where they're focused on. It's their spotlight episode.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get 2 2s and 2 1s.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And in an episode where you have a 1, it's not that you're not there, it's that you're kind of a supporting character.
Right.
Yeah. Does that address your question?
Yeah, you're the one that helps Hannibal get BA on the plane after he's passed out and gets the A-team to where they need to go, but you're not the one that it's all about.
Yeah, yeah.
Got it.
I also believe it's in the PTA rules. I'd have to check it out, but I don't think it stipulates that you have to have a conflict in every scene.
No, you don't. And don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that you know that's what the rules are. I'm suggesting the players were eager for it,
yeah.
is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And that was what was really driving them. Now, mind you, none of them had looked at the rule book ever, you know, except for one player, excuse me. One player had actually played before. But everyone else was brand new to the system. You know, this was their first exposure, so, you know, all they could take away was the highlights, you know. So yeah. that made it a little challenging. So I don't know that I would run this again as a mini-con game. You know, I think you'd get a lot more out of it. I had 4 hours to basically explain Shadowrun and Primetime Adventures and play a session.
That's a lot.
Seems like a
That's
lot.
A lot to do.
That's a lot. So that was perhaps a poor choice on my part. You know, maybe I should have just chosen like 20s detectives because, you know, everyone kind of knows what that is, right?
Yeah.
You know, so I wouldn't have to spend as much time talking about what the universe was all about, too. So. Anyway,
what?
So I sounded like people had a good time. I got some really good feedback on it, so that was okay.
Yeah.
And then we played Zombies in the Vineyard, which was an absolute blast. So, really good time.
And you know, to go back to your PTA talk, there are sessions with any game where all the players care about is just getting in, killing some stuff, and then going home and saying, yeah, we got them good.
Right.
So you may have just had one of those types of groups of players that time.
I think I'm having a really hard time making my point come across. Someday I'll think about how to make it better, but that may have had a contributing, you know, influence in it. So,
mm-hmm. Anyway. I also just as a last note about PTA, unless it leads to another one, I think PTA is a really hard game to run when the GM brings the setting and has to sell everybody on the setting. I think the sort of pregame portion where everybody designs the show together is a really crucial part of the game that helps make it work.
And I think what even made it more tough was they were more, in some ways, they were more interested in the setting, I think, than the actual game. So
and the Shadowrun setting is very much about killing people and taking their stuff, only this time you get machine guns and technology as well as just spells and swords.
Totally. So, anyway.
So there's that. But Zombies in the Vineyard.
Zombies in the Vineyard was an absolute blast. Carl Rigney, who I've mentioned before, he ran that for one of my coworkers, Paul Tevis, and I. And we sat down, I think it was like 9:30 on Saturday night, and Carl took us on kind of this really interesting journey from the zombie invasion, you know, all through kind of our first couple hours of survival of it. And kind of banding together to, you know, make it. Mm. What he did that was really interesting, and I'll have a hard time describing this, but if you're familiar with the Dogs in the Vineyard mechanic, there's bidding that goes on with different types of dice. And what he did in this case was he actually had, like, the infestation itself bidding against us. At certain points, you know, to see if we would actually be able to pull it off, or, you know, to pull off the things we were trying to accomplish.
So the bidding back and forth mechanic would be not against a character, but against kind of
the overall, like, you know, I'll say infestation kind of mood, you know, how we're feeling about it. You know,
because my
character never believed it was anything other than terrorists. He thought it was a terrorist attack that had happened. And he actually was ex-military, and one of his contacts worked for the CIA. So he, when this whole thing went down, he called back and said, is it just us that got hit, or is it everybody? And the dude's wife, you know, who he was friends with, said, he was called into work, it's hit Chicago, LA, Washington, D.C., New York, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They hit everywhere all at once. And so he was convinced it was terrorists. Had struck and successfully really, you know, messed up the United States. And even when signs of, you know, zombifiedness were hitting him, he just thought it was a biological agent. And, you know, you had all these three different characters on this very different emotional journey. That's where I was at. My friend Chris, who works at the store, his character had, I hope I'm not making this too long, his character was this dude who was middle management in his 40s and ran the mailroom for his company, right? So he was kind of basing him off of Michael Douglas from, what is it, Walking Tall or whatever it is. Falling Down, thank you.
Yeah.
Walking Tall. And he was just this angry, bitter little man. You know, literally little man who had nothing in his life, right? And during the whole anthrax thing, he let, you know, a piece of mail get through to the CEO that had anthrax, the FBI got involved, blah, blah, blah. To get himself, you know, out of looking suspicious for this, he basically turns over on the whole company. I'm telling this whole story because one of his traits was called, on Friday, I'll be somebody. And Friday was the day that the FBI was going to come down on the executives of the company, and he was going to be the person who ratted them out. Unfortunately, the zombie infestation happens on Tuesday. So his main driving goal is to make it to Friday. You know, that's all he cares about, because on Friday he's going to be somebody. And Paul's character, he was a software, you know, coder who his whole deal was his first, you know, kind of conflict in the game was convincing his wife that they weren't going to have a child yet. And it was really interesting because his goal was to get home. You know, that's what he cared about, as I recall. So we had these three very, very different journeys happening in, you know, 2.5 hours during this whole thing. And it was really good. It was really good. So
I'm really interested in the whole conflict against a concept or, you know, against a feeling, as you described it.
I'm hoping Carl will publish these. He wants our feedback on it, you know, even if he does it as a PDF or something like that. I would love to see him do something with it because it was a very, very immersive. Even with the dogs mechanic, which I do feel at times can kind of pull you out of it, it can be fairly intensive. This just really worked.
It can pull you out of it, but it feeds so much back into it.
Totally. No argument. But just the way that it just felt different this way. I don't know how to explain it, but yeah. I liked it a lot better.
Yeah. It also reminds me of extended contests in Agon. There's a kind of, it's the one thing that really feels like this in Agon, but it's kind of a back and forth mechanic to do something extended like a race against a storm, or, you know, it's for things like races and for fighting off a serious illness or enchantment or something like that. Just a total side note about mechanics that I don't even fully remember. So we'll move on.
Okay. And I think, what else have I been playing real quick? We'll finish that up. I've been painting Flames of War stuff a bunch. And, I've been playing a lot of Dead Rising. I'm bad. So, there you go.
It's a Xbox game or a
Xbox 360 game, yeah.
Yeah. Kind of a survival horror deal?
Yeah, you're in a mall. And you've dropped yourself off because you want to take pictures of this infestation that's happening. And it's pretty goddamn brutal.
So this is a zombie game that starts where, a zombie infestation is happening. I'm there.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
You get dropped off on the roof, and one of the mechanics of the game is for shooting photos of events, you know, that occur in front of you. And you score on different ratings and blah, 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 and that actually will, a good photo will really help you increase your level, so.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it's pretty immersive. It's bad. Yeah, it's no wow, but it's pretty immersive.
Well, it's Mall of America done in video game form.
Yeah, and oh man, you get to chop zombies up, you know, 45 different ways from Sunday because everything you pick up can be used as a weapon. So you can ride down the mall,
you can drive through people, and
yeah, you can ride down the mall on a skateboard, you know, wielding a katana. It's fantastic. And honestly, I think one of the things I saw recently was true. Mike Merrills, I think, was posting how kind of the story in this game really feels like it gets in the way. I totally agree. At times, I just want to kill damn zombies, and I've got to go do this thing or move the magic pickle to over here or whatever. And I just want to kill something. I don't care. Yeah.
Yeah, when games lose track of where their fun is,
yeah,
it is sad.
Yeah, I keep getting frustrated and putting the game down, so there you go. So I think that's mostly it. I played some Cold City, but I think we talked about that. Blah, blah,
okay,
blah.
Yeah. Alan, how about yourself?
Well, I managed to play Order of the Stick.
Hooray!
The Order of the Stick adventure game.
Yes.
And had mixed results.
Oh,
it was one of those situations where I had to go leave the game day mini con down at Endgame and be somewhere else for a while, and had an opportunity to game later with my own game group, or a couple of them. And so I didn't have time to sit down and really absorb the rules before saying, hey, I've got this new game.
Oh,
so we relied on the 8-page quick start rules, which claims to get you up and running and playing. It left out some pretty important details, like majorly important details, that were ultimately the sources of our frustrations in the games. Okay, we're not getting very far. Every new skill that I get is crap. Shouldn't these other characters that we're not playing be in here as well somehow, because you're supposed to be able to call on the other characters for help if they're on the same level of the dungeon as you? Well, yeah, they should have been, but that's in the main rule book halfway into the 32-page booklet. It's not in the 8-page quick start thing that says it gets you up and running. So that's partly our fault for going, okay, we don't have time, we're just going to do the quick start and go. And then partly the whole quick start name put to it. That should have been just a primer or some other name saying, okay, this gives you the basic idea, but to really play, you're going to need to read at the very least this many pages of the full book. There were significant things. It needed a few more funny little panels to describe the things we missed, and maybe one or two less jokes.
Yeah, rules writing can really make or break a game like that.
Totally true.
I think the quick start rules probably were hamstrung. They only had X number of pages to do. They're both amusing aside things with the characters and a walkthrough. And it got to the last half page and kind of went, oh, and there's this end game thing where you beat up the big bad lich Zykon.
Oh, if you're tight for space, man, you have a whole website where you can do the funny. You know, explain the game.
Yeah.
I'd have to give, maybe if I just dropped a grade on it, quick start rules, I'd give a B minus, maybe even a C plus. The game itself, I think, is a strong B plus, and for the right group, maybe even an A. It kind of Dungeoneer-ish and kind of Talisman-ish in certain ways. You kind of delve down into the dungeon, and other players play monster cards on you, more of them if you're deeper in the dungeon, and the monsters on the dungeon level can all support each other if they have things in common. All the ogres can support the ogre chieftain, and suddenly he's a badass you do not want to get in the way of. And you can call out with your loot saying, hey, Haley, I've got the bag of coins. Do you want this? And if that player agrees, you give them the loot card, and you get a bonus on your attack roll for the round. Things like that.
Huh.
So it's a neat game. I like the game. I think it has designed itself to be a lot longer than it needs to be, but then again, it was trying to emulate some pretty darn long games like Talisman and Dungeoneer and such.
And Munchkin.
And Munchkin. Oh, God.
Well, yeah, oh, there's another 30 minutes of game in a 2.5-hour bag.
And the other, like, 3 minutes of game.
Oh,
but anyway.
Hey, now.
I can't.
I will have to say that I'm quasi sad because the game is not matching how it did at Gen Con in my store. So,
really?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting on a lot of it. So,
I kind of feel like, everybody who was going to be super hardcore about that game was at Gen Con and got it there. Maybe.
Yeah, or the word hasn't gotten out yet. I don't know. So.
Yes.
I'm still meeting people that are hardcore D&D fans that don't even know about Order of the Stick yet. And, maybe this game will interest you because it has D&D-related jokes, and they're into it. They like it, but they just weren't aware of it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we'll see.
We're going to give the game another run through before I make any final, call to dismiss or embrace the game. but it has some issues, particularly with the quick start rules. Let's see what else. I've been reading through, for the first time ever, something published or distributed by Kenzer and Company.
Whoa.
It's a Necromancer Games title that is just going through Kenzer, the mother of all treasure tables.
Hmm.
Bad name.
Yes.
But it is just an exceptionally useful resource for fantasy game masters, particularly D&D, but it could be used for other games as well. It just goes through and makes massive lists of basic treasure, and it will go into great detail. This box contains a painting. The painting is of this. Underneath that, there is a folded linen shirt that has a black dagger. The dagger looks like this. It gives values for each thing. It has chapters where there's a 100 gold piece worth of treasure, and you can convert this to other game systems and such and use it for whatever you're playing if it's not D&D. And it goes way up into epic level disgusting treasure hoards, and it does this for every category of coinage, of wealth that you want your players to find. Just picking and choosing little bits out of each of these treasures and making your own treasure hoard is useful enough. This extremely useful resource, and I think it's one of the few books that brags that it might be the most useful thing you buy this year and might be right. So, I like it.
So hundreds in each of these categories? Is that what we're talking about? I'm trying to make some kind of comparison in my head to things like, 100 great treasures for $2 that you find on the PDF sites. And it's like, maybe if you just scale that up, eventually you get this.
If you scale that up and describe them a bit better, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess it comes down to writing quality as well.
Yeah, from what I've seen in PDF products, the inspiration runs out about halfway through on this sort of thing and starts becoming quite obviously borrowed from other free online sources and drawing from the SRD as much as possible. And this seemed to go the extra mile. It's from Necromancer Games and Tabletop Adventures, and it's worth taking a look at.
Yeah, cool.
And then my weekly D&D games still going strong, and people were recovering a dead body of a friend that got stolen for no reason that they could tell, so that was fun. Like, hey, we don't have to worry about Flame striking the caravan because he's already dead. Get him!
So, oh.
Yeah, it kind of went that way, but it was still amusing.
That's very sad. I have no playing to report this time, which works out because we're about out of time for the show.
Oh, hooray!
Right. Yeah, just with the way scheduling worked out, I had to skip I had to skip a game session, and we'll be back on this Thursday. But
all right.
Yeah, maybe we will play Primetime Adventures.
Ooh.
So we can do a little compare and contrast when that happens.
Yeah.
Last thoughts to toss out there. I wanted to remind everybody what my Skype voicemail is. At least I think I have my Skype voicemail turned on.
Yeah, check that.
Useful.
I'll check that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but my Skype name is Misuba, same as it is on the site. So, if I get that fired up, look for me and ask us questions or give us comments or just say a thing.
Yeah, we want to do a call-in show at some point. So.
Yes.
Skype into his name, leave a little message with who you are and what you want to discuss, and maybe we'll ignore you. Maybe we'll answer it.
The more of you can demonstrate that, you are capable of leaving Skype voicemail, the more likely it is that we will do a call-in show, and that will be exciting. Exactly. So
which distillery is going to sponsor the show? Because I'm going to need to be liquored up.
My only data point there is I was drinking Glenfiddich tonight.
That's awesome.
Right. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be contacting them, though.
I was asked, why don't you write them an email?
Yeah, we'd like to tarnish your brand.
Yeah, basically.
What's local to us, Chris? We could go hit them up in person.
Yeah.
Well, any excuse. That's about all we got this week. Seriously, I'm putting a cap on this.
All right.
I'm Mike Sugarbaker.
This is Alan Sugarbaker. I'm not looking directly at you.
Oh, dude. This is Chris Anderhan. Happy Halloween, even though it's probably
yes!
Happy. Hooray, Halloween!
Enjoy your honorary annual Clohu game or whatever it is that you do.
Because you know you're playing it.
Unless you already did, in which case I hope it went well.
Yes. Happy Halloween. We'll see you next time.